Now back to our main topic today, information overload. Our guest today is Clay Johnson, who has a new book out, The Information Diet. He was the founder of Blue State Digital. That's the firm that built and managed Barack Obama's online campaign site in 2008. He joins us now from WABE in Atlanta. Clay, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you, too. And, you know, the thing that I wonder about most with this idea is that we really don't know for sure what the impact on our brains is from all this information flowing at us all the time. What do we know for sure, and what should we be worried about?
Well, we know that we don't have complete control of how information affects us, much like we don't have complete control over how food affects us. And we do also know that every time we learn something new, it results in a physiological change in the brain. And so we end up with this space where, hey, guess what? Just like when we eat food, our bodies change, same thing happens when you're listening to this radio program.
And so with all this information coming at us, potentially what kind of problem might we have with all these changes going on to our brains?
Well, the science isn't all there yet. And it won't be for quite some time. Again, just like food, you know, when William Banting was inventing the first diet, the first at least Western diet book, the calorie was used as a unit of measurement for measuring the efficiency of steam engines, not really, the efficiency of food in our body. The same thing is there with science. But there are some risks, you know, in the information diet, my book, I hooked an M-Wave 2 device up. It's sort of a heart rate monitor / breath meter, and found that I was holding my breath whenever I was checking my email, whenever I received a new email. And I asked my friends to text me throughout the day, and found that my heart rate would increase by about 15% if I got a text message and didn't check it. And I'm totally, you don't know my friends, but I'm totally uncomfortable with my friends being able to do that to my heart.
You know, I think I operate a similar way, but it's kind of a scary idea to me that you're saying we're changing so rapidly in terms of how much information we digest every day, and yet we don't really know what kind of impact that might be having on us.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing that happened with food. We industrialized agriculture, and the impact of that is obesity. We are human beings that are almost all of nature thrives well with scarcity, but doesn't do quite well with abundance. And to say that information is immune to that is not true.
You know, how likely is it, how possible might it be, though, that our ability to process information might wind up being warped by all the junk we're exposing ourselves to?
Well, I mean, that's a great point. The question I always ask is, who wants to hear the truth when they can hear that they're right? You know, the thing that's different today that, you know, wasn't the case 50 years ago is now, no matter what crazy thought that enters your head, there's a minor media outlet out there willing to tell you that you're right so that they can profit from it.
You know, you say we spend about 11 hours a day consuming information. How much information are we attempting to digest typically?
Well, it's anywhere from between 80,000 to 200,000 words per day. You can measure it in words, you can measure it in bytes, you can measure it in time. I prefer to measure it in time, that 11-hour figure, because really time is our only non-renewable resource. We don't process information like computers do. You know, it doesn't fill your brain up more when you watch a high-definition television program or a standard-definition program, even though it, you know, takes more space on your computer or whatever.
But
time is the thing that we lose. And the interesting thing with the health complications of a poor information diet is it's not as though we're spending all 11 of those hours on a treadmill or walking around outside. We're usually sitting down, and sitting down is really quite deadly.
Moving away from the whole notion of the physiological impact on the brain, do scientists even know if there's a limit to how much information we can consume?
Well, I mean, is there a limit to how big our waistlines can get? We keep proving that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there's, I have yet to meet someone who is, you know, in the midst of reading a book in the library and their head explodes because it's filled up with too much information.
Although I feel that way more and more. I was going to say, you know, some days doing this show and I do, I cover politics for the newspaper here, I get home in the evenings and my wife will ask me at 6 o'clock, well, who was on the radio today? And some days I can tell her, but some days I always sort of stammer around and say, well, that was 6 hours ago, honey. That's a long time ago.
When you do sound checks for radio, right, they always ask you, tell me what you had for breakfast this morning. That's sort of their sample question. And there's been some times where I'm like, I don't know what I had for breakfast this morning. Of course, but there's this idea of information overload, right, and that the information itself is the thing that's the problem. And I want to dispose of that notion. I don't think – you know, we don't say that people are suffering from food overload. If someone's eating too much fried chicken, there are a lot of things to blame there. It could be, you know, lack of access to quality food, or it could be overeating. But it's not the chicken's fault. We shouldn't be blaming the food for our consumption problem. We shouldn't be blaming the information for our information overload problem. It's an information overconsumption, or at least an information malnutrition problem that we've got.
And that gets to one of your main points, which is that consumers can control what they're consuming.
That's right. And we have to be conscious consumers. The subtitle of the book is A Case for Conscious Consumption. And I think that that has a lot to do not only with your consumption habits for your own health, but also for your community's health and society's health in general. You have to remember, especially online, your clicks have consequences. A poor information diet has as much of an ethical consequence as a poor food diet. I'll give you an example. You know, everything that you – let's say you're a Huffington Post reader. Everything that you click on the Huffington Post is being measured. So if you're clicking on more of the stuff in the right-hand sidebar that has to do with Snooki and J-Lo, then you're not just clicking on that. You're voting for that content, and you're saying, I want more of that content produced. Even I want more of that content produced for people like me. And the stuff that you're not clicking on doesn't get written to more. And so now we are creating a journalist because we've industrialized media and we've industrialized journalism. Those companies have a fiduciary responsibility to create content that people are asking for, not particularly content that people need.
So there's a moral imperative involved here.
Very much so. Yeah, your clicks have consequences.
We're visiting, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're visiting with Clay Johnson, author of a new book, The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. We're wondering, how much time do you spend in front of one kind of screen or another, TV and computer? Do you keep a conscious eye on what you and your kids watch, read, and listen to? Is it time for you to get on an information diet? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, Clay, you make a lot of analogies, and you are this morning already, between media consumption and food consumption. Here's one point you make in the book. Poor information leads to ignorance. Lousy food leads to disease.
Right. And I actually, you know, one of my mottos is, you know, confirmation bias is the new H1N1. As we continue to tell ourselves what it is that we want to hear rather than it is what it is that we need to hear, we end up not being able to change our minds very well.
And we're drawn to that. Why? Because in politics, that's become a huge issue. People don't want to expose themselves to any viewpoints outside of their own worldview. What about that?
Well, the science isn't entirely there yet, but I do have a theory. And my theory is that it's about energy consumption. And it's about that it actually costs your brain. And there are some scientific studies out there that are alluding to this, although none have – I want to be really clear that there's not – I don't have a solid case to be made here. But I think it has to do with energy consumption and energy preservation. Hebb's law – Hebb was a neuroscientist – states that basically neurons that fire together wire together, that when you begin that physiological change in your brain that I mentioned earlier, when you learn something new, those neurons in your brain get closer together, and it costs less energy for them to transmit between each other. And so you automatically seek out confirmation because it's easier to think that way. Mm-hmm. It costs you less energy. And your brain consumes more energy in your body, I think, than any other organ that you've got.
Did not know that.
Yeah, I think the right number is it's in the book somewhere, but I think the right number is 20%. Your brain consumes 20% of your body's energy, and represents, I think, you know, something like a seventh or an eighth of its weight.
So, what are some other symptoms of information obesity?
I think a lack of time sense. That's the one that's really interesting to me. You just lose time. This idea that when you wake up in the morning and, you know, sit in front of a screen, that the whole day flies by, that's not something that used to happen. You know, that's a new occurrence, this idea that, oh my gosh, I just looked up from the screen and it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's time to go home. Our ability to lose time is affected by our dopamine receptors. And it turns out that when we're constantly seeking out new information, we lose a sense of time. Poor working memory or short-term memory is another effect. So this idea of, like, I can't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, that's also a symptom.
You're talking to me very directly there, Clay.
This idea of email apnea, this idea that you start holding your breath and your heart rate changes, that is a huge symptom of information overconsumption. But I'm more worried about the affirmative media consumption, that we're losing our mental pliability to change our minds. And that to me is the most scary of all, because that ability for us to have dialogue and have a flexibility of mind is the thing that's critical to our democracy. And if we lose that, then democracy can't scale.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here on Up to Date. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Carol from Olathe, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. You made the analogy earlier that it's not the chicken's fault. Well, I beg to differ with that. I think it is the chicken's fault, because that's the chicken's reason for being. It's like you can't even have a normal conversation with someone anymore. You have to go on the Facebook page, and when you go on the Facebook page, you're exposed to all the facts about that person and all the facts about their friends. It's the same thing with work. You can't just do your job. You have to know a little bit more than what your job requires just to stay in the loop. And I think it's changing the culture to where you just can't take in the information that you need just by going online. You're faced with more information, and you're forced to digest that information. And I think that not only is it psychically damaging to us, it's also, as you mentioned previously, it's damaging to our physical bodies as well.
Yeah, I think I want to be clear here. When I say don't blame the chicken, I mean chickens are not volunteering to off themselves reanimate their corpses and jump into deep fryers and then get out of the deep fryers and fly into our mouths. And information, you know, all of the information that you're being exposed to, it's dangerous to think that information is some form of inanimate object that is, you know, making itself and producing it for us. You know, Facebook is led by a person named Mark Zuckerberg, and it has an engineering team, and it has lots of people who are consciously trying to figure out how to get you to click on things. And this is being done not by information itself, but by people. And people are also consuming it. And so we have to think about the economics of our information consumption, the economics of our news, the economics of our entertainment, and understand that, again, just as we industrialized agriculture and agricultural companies have a fiduciary responsibility to produce cheap but very popular food, and the outcome of that is obesity, we have also industrialized media. And the outcome of that is cheap but very popular information, and the outcome of that is ignorance.
But the information doesn't lead to knowledge.
No, information never leads to knowledge. I mean, that's...
Well, I wouldn't say it never does. It should, but it doesn't in this case.
No, it can't without a person involved.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into person, and if I'm wanting to expose myself to information so that I can have knowledge, but that's not the diet I'm being offered, that's problematic for me.
But you're in control of that diet, and that's part of what I'm talking about in the book, is that you do have choices. There are lots of ways for you to consume better online and offline. You can live in. You know, I'll give you some suggestions. I recommend that you try and live an ad-free lifestyle, to try and avoid advertisements, at least avoid consciously consuming.
I don't want TV, so I'm trying to contribute to that.
Great. Another thing is to start with a local information diet and then go to, you know, end with a global information diet. Be more concerned with your spouse and your family than you are with the president and his spouse and family. And be more concerned with your state representative than your United States representative. The number of times that I go around and give talks like this, and I ask people two questions. What is the obesity rate in this county? And then the next question I ask is, who was Kim Kardashian's ex-husband? And the number of people everybody knows the latter, nobody knows the former. And that, I think, is really dangerous. But the knowledge of, you know, you can look up the obesity rate in your county by going to countyhealthrankings.org. Mm-hmm. And they take a lot of data from all over the place and try and figure out what it is that, you know, the health of your county. But getting closer to that makes the news, getting closer to home makes the news more actionable and relevant to you. And I think that's very a vital, important part to an information diet.
Carol, thank you for the call. Clay, just before we go to a break, is there something scary about all this? The place where we are today, not really knowing, so many folks struggling to manage this information flow, and then also not knowing exactly what all this stuff is doing to our brains?
I think so. I mean, I'm more terrified about what it is doing at a societal level. You know, we have things like the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movements that are people that actively want to participate in their democracy. But, you know, having been in Washington for the past 10 years, I can tell you that the disconnect between these activists and the knowledge of how Washington actually works is scary. And part of the reason behind that is because, you know, people want to believe what it is that they want to believe. They don't want to believe the complicated stuff.
Again, we're talking with Clay Johnson, his new book, The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how to manage this onslaught of information that's going into our noggins every day, how to help our kids manage all this, and how Clay got onto this idea to begin with. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you're looking for a great film, you'll find our critics' recommendations for the best indie, foreign, and doc films showing on area screens at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at creating elder-friendly communities as the number of Americans in or nearing retirement age expands. This hour, we're visiting with Clay Johnson, who has a new book out, The Information Diet. He's the founder of Blue State Digital, the firm that built and managed Barack Obama's online campaign site in 2008. If you want to join our conversation and talk to us about how much time you're spending in front of one screen or another and how it might be affecting your kids, your worries about that, 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to some folks who have been waiting for a little bit here. Roger from Kansas City, Missouri. Roger, good morning.
Well, I guess my question is, with all the data that's out there, you can skew it in any form you actually want it. How do you cut through it and find out what the, you know, what you're actually looking for and what the true information is?
Good question, Roger. Clay, how do you cut through it all?
That's a great question. I say, first off, avoid processed information. Try and stick close to source material. I think our news outlets actually do a terrible job of this because they want to preserve ad revenue. So, for instance, when the New York Times is writing about a bill, or actually the New York Times does a pretty good job of it. When a local paper usually writes about a bill in a state house or a bill in Congress, they rarely link to the bill. And I don't expect everyone to read bills themselves, but I expect our news outlets to at least provide us with the opportunity for us to make up our own minds, which a lot just don't.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that because they don't want people leaving their websites because they want to create more advertising dollars. So getting close to source material is a good idea. I think, again, as I mentioned in the earlier segment, staying local. The other interesting byproduct of being close to your local information rather than national or global information is that you have the opportunity to verify it yourself. You know, if there's toxic waste being dumped in your neighbor's yard, you can drive over to your neighbor's house and see the toxic waste yourself. And you can avoid some of that sensationalization. I think really mastering some digital literacy is very important, and really honing your digital literacy skills.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think our definition of literacy is an evolving thing, and it's always been evolving. You know, the definition of literacy 100 years ago was the ability to sign your name. Today, it's generally considered the ability to read a newspaper from cover to cover. But I think people who say today, I'm not a computer person, aren't considered illiterate. But I think 20 years from now, if someone says, I'm not a computer person, then they will be considered functionally illiterate by society. And you see that in the job market today, where technology, there's a, you know, a technology job shortage. I'm sorry, over supply. You know, we can't find enough technology people, but in a lot of other fields, that's not the case. I think what digital literacy means is really the ability to, one, understand your computer, the not be afraid of it, the ability to use Google in its more advanced, or Bing or whatever in its more advanced forms, the ability to manage a spreadsheet and manipulate it, and to have some basic form of statistical knowledge, to know things like causation and correlation aren't the same thing. I think those are vital parts of a healthy information diet. But the most important one is really stick close to source material. That also means, people ask me a lot, hey, you know, if I'm reading a bunch of data, if all I'm doing is reading a bunch of spreadsheets, doesn't that take a lot of time? And the answer to that is yes. I encourage depth of knowledge over breadth of knowledge. It doesn't do you a lot of good to know a whole bunch about a little thing, a little bit about a whole bunch of things that you can't do much about.
Mm-hmm. Roger, I hope that helps. Let's go to Gus from Overland Park. Gus, good morning.
Hello. I'm sorry. This is ridiculous that you can go to source materials. Okay, so we have to, all right, let's go to the Congress in Washington and ask questions, and I mean that's ridiculous. I mean, you can do that with reading sources that you trust in, and you can learn about sources that you trust in by reading curmudgeons and people like that you agree with, and who they source you to sources that are trustworthy. It's ridiculous to think you just have to start with local before you go beyond local.
Clay, do you want to respond to some of that?
I'm sorry, you disagree.
Yeah. Anything else, Clay?
I would imagine I ask this question of who's your state rep, and who's your
Between your tongue.
Yeah, go ahead, Clay.
The interesting thing there is no one knows even who their state representative is. You don't have to go to Washington to make a significant change in politics. You know, states have rights, and states have the ability to control a lot of things in your daily life. Your city council person or your state representative has much more of an impact on your daily life than your member of Congress does. And the interesting thing is that they have less people trying to get to them than a member of Congress. It always has puzzled me in 10 years in politics why the ballot box for president of the United States is more full than the ballot box for state rep.
You know, somebody who covers this stuff for a living, I think you're making a great point. Gus, I'll give you one more bite of the apple here.
You don't need to. You can still comment, and you can learn about things beyond, you know, I mean, how many molecules of fungus between your toes? How many do you have between your toes? I mean, that's just ridiculous. You can learn about your representatives. You can do all the stuff locally, but you can also still learn things above that and beyond that, and in the world and in the government.
Gus, I appreciate what you have to say. All I'm trying to make a point to you is that it's important to give priority to information that's actually actionable and relevant to
you. Let's go to Jason from Warrensburg. Jason, you're on the program with Clay Johnson. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? Great topic. Really deep into this whole thing, following the whole conversation. Following up, you were talking about Mark Zuckerberg and then also going into kind of the media ownership. I taught some media literacy courses, and that was one of the big things I found is making sure that students were aware of who owns the media that they're consuming. And so just the fact that I mentioned to the guy I was talking to before, the basically 95% of the media that we consume is owned by a handful of corporations, five or six major media corporations. And just understanding where that's coming from and who owns it and the ideologies that are behind all that is important, I feel. Just your comments would be useful.
Yeah, I agree. I'll say something that'll make a lot of people call me as ridiculous as Gus just did. I'm a proponent of changing the names of most high school English departments to critical thinking departments.
Hmm.
I think we should still maintain much of the curriculum, but I think we need to place the emphasis on what the value of those teachers really create are, and the idea of reading and writing reports and sourcing materials and you know, linking to sources and sourcing your documents and those things. That's a critical thinking skill that you're teaching. It's not English proficiency that you're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like to get there, and I think, you know, media literacy is part of that. I think social media literacy is part of that. Digital literacy is part of that. You know, if you look at the Trayvon Martin stuff, you'll find at least my Facebook feed. I'm originally from Georgia. I live in Washington D.C. I'm a recovering left of center political activist, and my because of that, because I have many conservative friends and many liberal friends, my Facebook feed is filled with people saying that, you know, Trayvon was a thug and Trayvon was not a thug and Trayvon was a victim.
Yeah.
And people are sourcing all kinds of information, false and unfalse, false and true, that affirms their beliefs but mm-hmm. doesn't ever help us get close to the truth.
Let's go back to this.
We need that.
Clay, go back to this idea of consolidated ownership of the media, just half a dozen companies owning so much of what we read and consume when it comes to the news. What does that mean? What's the impact of that in terms of, you know, how these companies are, like the Kansas City Star, are operated? Because, you know, no one's telling me really what to cover and what to write, and I'm wondering how you see that.
Well, I think, you know, it's unfortunate, but the economic model of the newspaper isn't doing quite well right now.
Mm-hmm. Tell me
part
about
of the
it.
Reason why is because it's having to compete with, I think, this affirmative-based media. You know, when you walk out, when you walk online, right? And again, there's not a minor media outlet out there waiting to confirm your beliefs. You know, you can believe that Barack Obama is from Kenya and find evidence that claims that he is from Kenya, despite the fact that he's produced his birth certificate. And you can believe that the, you know, World Trade Center was an inside, the September 11th was an inside job. And there's, you know, evidence online. It's not real evidence, but there's evidence online that will point you in that direction. And that's really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the economic model that our newspapers are having to compete with. But what the newspaper business is doing to compete with that is try to be more objective, which is actually just not, I think, the answer. I think it's proven to be not the answer. As a colleague of mine, Jay Rosen, at NYU, says that that's a view from nowhere, that journalists provide this sort of objective view that doesn't want to have any belief itself. So
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden journalists are saying that, well, maybe the world is flat,
mm-hmm.
And giving the flat earthers equal time. That doesn't make much sense to me.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Clay Johnson, author of The Information Diet, about all this information that flows at us every day, how we process it, and how we ought to better manage it every day. Clay, how did you wind up writing this book? How did you get started on the idea?
Well, after I left the the Democratic Party and being a Democratic Party operative in 2008, I started working at the Sunlight Foundation, which is really dedicated to government transparency. Mm-hmm. And the idea was if we can just get data out of government and make it consumable for people, then they will the American people will be more educated and make more rational decisions. But then I was walking home from work one day. I was walking in front of the White House, and there was a guy holding a sign over his head, and it said, keep your government hands off my Medicare, which didn't make any sense because Medicare is a government-run program. And I stopped and talked with him, and he was a really smart guy who just happened to be holding a sign over his head that was completely, well, idiotic. But he knew a whole bunch of stuff. And then it sort of hit me that there was a difference between being well-informed and highly informed.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was highly informed. He wasn't very well-informed. He could talk to me more about, you know, the constitutional qualifications for being president of the United States than I knew. He certainly didn't put two and two together to think about how possible it was for government to keep its hand off a government-run program. And then the next day, I was running around my neighborhood. I live near the former Walter Reed Army Hospital, mm-hmm. and there was a woman holding a sign over her head that said, "Enlist here to die for Halliburton." And you know, that didn't make much sense to me either, because mm-hmm. the Army would never run a recruitment center inside of an Army hospital. And you know, there was a guy that was, you know, he was actually running faster than me, but he didn't have any legs, which is both inspiring and humiliating at the same time. But
meaning he was using
it was pretty much just inspiring.
A prosthesis of some kind you're talking about.
Yeah, he was running on two double prosthetics. It was mm-hmm. unbelievable. And I tried to keep up with him, but it was more like just a cool breeze just went past me. But, you know, this kind of dialogue is the thing that got me thinking about this and understanding that my work at Sunlight wasn't really going to have the effect that I wanted it to, because it wasn't going to be a panacea, because the idea that locally sourced, you know, like here's this government data or here's this, you know, independently verifiable data can't compete with the likes of Glenn Beck and Keith Olbermann and this sort of sensationalized media.
Hmm. How have you wound up changing your own habits as a result of writing this book?
Well, now we get to the tough part, don't we? The information diet, the book, has really ruined my information diet. I plead guilty to, you know, do as I say and not as I do a lot. You know, after the book has come out, I have spent a lot of time talking about and listening to news about the book, and I really ought not to do that. Over the past few weeks, I've been a little bit more reclusive. My wife and I have a baby that's due any day now, so we're busy prepping
the
house and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I hope to get on a normal information diet again as soon as that baby pops out.
Well, speaking of babies and then speaking of kids, how is information overconsumption affecting our children's learning abilities?
That's a really interesting question. There's actually a lot more studies around children and information consumption than there is around adults and information consumption, which I find kind of ironic that we're more likely to experiment on our children than we are ourselves in this field. But you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. For instance, you know, there've been a lot of repeated studies about how we should really keep glowing rectangles or screens, any kinds of screens, away from our kids until after they're about 2 years old. That there's a lot of negative effects from a correlation to childhood obesity to lack of ability to focus and lack of multitasking capabilities around putting a screen in front of a child over 2 years old or under 2 years old. And that includes iPads, iPhones, television sets, whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny though, when we were kids, at least when I was a kid, there was this concern that we were spending, way too much time in front of the TV. You know, we didn't know how that would affect things either, that we were just turning off our minds and staring at Gilligan's Island and McHale's Navy and all those good shows, and that was going to have all kinds of impacts on our heads.
I think it really has. The point of me making the food analogy so much in the book is to demonstrate that this is not just an analogy, that these things are actually related.
Yeah.
That we've been trained to be information consumers, and that is making us obese. That maybe the obesity rate is so high in the United States. In 1986, the average obesity rate was 10%. Today it is 35%. That is a remarkable number, and it's deadly. We are now the first generation to have children's life expectancy starting to go down. If you look at some of the poorer counties in the South, in particular in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, they've seen male and female life expectancies start to go down, that's strongly correlated with obesity. And I think that this obesity thing is happening because we've changed our jobs and we've changed our lifestyles such that we're not exercising. We're blissed out in front of the television getting what it is that we want to hear rather than what it is that's good for us.
Again, our guest is Clay Johnson. He's the author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. Let's spend the few minutes we have left, Clay, talking about how folks, some practical information to help folks deal with all this. You offer some steps in the book to improve our data literacy. Let's look at them. One of them is search and how to look for correct information. You've touched on some of these things already, but let's walk through them again.
Well, I think really using Google to find or Bing, or I sound like a Google affinity, but there are lots of search engines
sure.
out there. Using a search engine to sort of dive deeper into information. I know that there's a lot of distrust amongst a lot of people for government, but government data in particular has a high tendency of truth. It's very hard to say that this candidate received this amount of money from a politician and sort of forge that or to lie about weather reports. That kind of thing is just not happening, at least not at the FEC or the Weather Channel level. It's important to use Google to sort of seek out that information. So in politics, I say, look, instead of listening to a campaign advertisement or even a debate, try and figure out who Mitt Romney is associating himself with, who is he accepting campaign contributions from, and who is Barack Obama associating himself with, and who is he accepting campaign contributions from? What does his social mm-hmm. network look like? That's going to help you make a more informed decision than listening to the candidate speak. Remember that the job of a politician is to persuade you, not to inform you, and it's very rarely to provide you with facts or to arm you with facts. It's much more to persuade you to vote for them.
Yeah.
That's their job.
Clay, just 30 seconds left. You also talk about filter and process, how to weed out what you don't need. Maybe that's the key question.
Yeah, and the easiest way to do that is to go local. It's to, Mark Zuckerberg said that, that people care more about a squirrel dying in their front yard than they do a genocide in Africa. And while that's stomach churning for me, I guarantee you that if a squirrel died in my front yard, that problem would be solved a lot faster than a genocide in Rwanda would be by me.
That's interesting. Clay Johnson's been our guest. His new book, The Information Diet. Thanks for taking some time with us, Clay. I sure enjoyed it. All the best. Clay Johnson is author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. You'll find guest bios, information about our program, and podcasts of our show all at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, creating elder-friendly communities as the number of Americans in or nearing retirement age expands. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.